A podcast of the cinema.
My name's Dave White. I'm a film critic. Sometimes I write for the Wrap. Most of the time I just do this kind of talking thing.
I'm Alonzo Duralde. I'm the film reviews editor at the Wrap and film critic and TV recapper over at What the Flick on the Young Turks Network. And I do this here podcast with Dave White, who is my husband.
My husband.
Mahogany.
Listen, you're not the one that spent time in a trailer park as a child. That was me. You went to fancy private school. You don't say, my husband. That's not how you talk at all. I'm the hick from the sticks, and you're the fancy boy
my parents,
from fancy town.
My parents were immigrants, so shut up.
Yeah, who came to the United States. Ready to get fancy. Oh, I've seen the photographs. I've seen the photographs of their courtship where your mother essentially looks like Grace Kelly in training.
She was a nursing student at the time.
And she wore impeccable dresses impeccably and looked pretty all the time.
It was the 50s. And everything looked better.
That's right. I'm just saying. Fancy people. I know what I saw.
Fine.
Would you like to discuss some films this week?
Why not?
There's
only one that we both saw.
That's not true.
Yes.
No.
What?
We saw... Oh, wait, you're right.
Yes. Don't contradict me. I know what I'm talking about.
I'm pulling up the list going, wait, I saw... No, I didn't see that. Oh, wait, no, he didn't see... Okay, yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
We got to talk, we're going to talk about The Mummy,
mm-hmm.
which you saw and I refused to see.
Yes.
We are going to talk about It Comes at Night,
mm-hmm.
which I saw and you didn't get to.
I wouldn't mind seeing it, but it just didn't work out with my schedule.
Didn't see Beatrice or Beatrice, depending on who you are, at dinner.
Beatrice at dinner.
You saw that. I did not. Also, you saw The Hero.
Yes.
And I have not, but we both saw Megan Levy.
Woo! I also saw My Cousin Rachel, but you want to see it and talk about it, so we're going to sit on that one for a week.
We're going to wait on that one till next week.
Because I'm a bit of an outlier on that one. That's gotten mostly positive reviews, and I was not down.
But look, it's a period film, and it's got Rachel Weisz, and those are two of my jams.
Well, Stephanie Zacharyk has my back. She was also not feeling this one, so... You can go read my review at The Wrap, and next week Dave and I will talk about it.
I have
in
never
depth.
Met Stephanie Zacharyk.
She was very nice.
And therefore, I do not care if she has your back.
I met her at South by Southwest. She was very nice.
I'm sure she's lovely.
Yes.
I'm sure she's a great person.
Is my eye...
I do read her. She's a good film critic. Yeah, I do read her.
Is my eye looking weird? It's like it's itchy. Is it red or inflamed or anything?
Your eye or the space where your glasses are touching the pieces around your eye?
No, my eye.
No, it looks okay.
Okay.
Do you need to stop and go like...
No, I'll be fine.
Put drops or something?
I'll do that later.
Are we having a problem that's going to interrupt this professional podcast of the cinema?
I don't think so. I think we can carry on.
Are you sure of that?
Yes. If I need to stop, I will stop.
Okay.
Great. We both saw Megan Levy.
It's boring. Tell people what it's about.
It's not as bad as you think, but it's not that all that good either. So, Kate Mara, who I finally figured out is Kate Mara and not Rooney Mara, because for a long time I would get them. I know they're two different ones, but I would just put the wrong name on the wrong one.
But you can tell that you can spot the difference
yes,
in a room.
Obviously. It's not like they're twins or anything, but I just for some reason would always call one the wrong. It's like how my mother would go through all of my brother's names and the dog's name before landing on
I
mine.
I get it. I understand.
Anyway, Kate Mara, the one who gets pushed in front of a subway on House of Cards, spoiler for something happened three seasons ago, is Megan Levy. And she has kind of a go-nowhere life in upstate New York, and her mother is Edie Falco, and who is not nice to her. And so Megan decides she's going to fix her life by joining the Marines. And she whips her way through basic training and then is still kind of a mess. But then after going out late and getting drunk and peeing on a building, she has to clean out dog cages as a punishment and discovers that she really likes the dogs and wants to be...
Sure, who doesn't like the
wants
dogs?
Wants to be one of the Marines that trains the dogs.
Everyone loves a doggy.
Who sniff out the IEDs in the war. And so she buckles down and you know, passes the tests and does all the things so she can become a dog trainer. And so she winds up going to Iraq or Afghanistan?
I forget.
I think it's Afghanistan.
I can't remember.
She goes to the war with the dog. And,
one of our two horrible wars.
Yes. And the dog bravely smells out bombs and they are in a lot of danger and they survive. And I have to say, for a lot of the things that this movie either doesn't do well or does okay, I thought the combat sequences were really quite well done. The director, Gabriella Cowperthwaite, it's her narrative debut. She directed Blackfish.
Yes.
She comes from documentary.
Yes.
And I thought the actual battle sequences of the dogs, like, sniffing out the mines and, you know, here's the thing. I watch Homeland for what the flick,
yes.
And we see every year we get about five or six War on Terror movies of some stripe or other.
Yep, we sure do.
So we have seen the scene of the, like, going through the house and the, you know, little kids cowering in the corner and the stack of prayer rugs and the guy in the turban who might be nice or might be hiding ISIS people or whatever.
Yes.
We've seen variations of those scenes a million times by now. They've become cliche. And this movie, they felt immediate and exciting, and I thought really well put together.
Shaking my head no at you right now.
I thought, I'm going to give this movie credit for that. I thought it did that part really well. The other stuff is kind of whatever. You don't... Megan Levy is really not...
Is it only kind of whatever? It's full on whatever.
No, I mean, it's... I didn't loathe this movie. Yeah. I just was not as engaged with it as I wanted to be. It does, I will say this, it tries to mix two very disparate genres, and it does so without embarrassing itself. It is a war movie, and it is also a, you know, it's a person experiences growth by becoming a Marine movie, and it's a person experiences growth by bonding with a dog movie. That's a lot of things to be, and it doesn't blow it on any of those accounts. It's just kind of dull. In a lot of ways. And then they, whoever, the whole last third of the movie is Megan trying to adopt the dog and the Marines not wanting to let her adopt the dog because the dog, like Megan, has PTSD, basically, is the premise. And that,
yes,
that, like, these dogs shouldn't be out, like, they're going to bite a kid if they're out in the street freaking out about something. And so Megan has to fight to get the dog back, going to the point of going to her senator, Chuck Schumer, to appeal to him to get the dog. And the guy they cast to play Chuck Schumer doesn't look at all like Chuck Schumer. It's like they,
right,
it's like they didn't know until that's the not day of shooting which member of Congress it was going to be. So they just found some sort of generic white guy who could be like anybody but Tulsi Gabbard, basically, you know. And they're like, okay, oh, you're going to be Chuck Schumer. All right, great, go. So I don't know. I there were things about this movie that I thought worked. But it's less than it could have been, but it's certainly better than it might have been.
I've had my fill of films about the trouble. I've had my fill of narrative films about the trouble of soldiers from Iraq and Afghanistan. And the reason I've had my fill is because they are so cookie cutter. So many of them cover the same beats. They have the same look. the stories are different, and they're trying to tell, you know, different stories. You know, this particular soldier's story is different from this other particular soldier's story. Very often they're based on true stories. But the films themselves are almost generic. They rely on so much of the same material. And I don't feel like any of them are telling me anything new. I know that it was a horrible situation.
Mm-hmm.
I know that we were there because of lies. I know that it gave soldiers PTSD. I know that they made them go back for multiple tours against their will. I know that after that, some of them, you know, descended into, you know, terrible consequential behavior. Some of them were murdered by other people with PTSD. I know, because I've seen all of them. And there's got to be a way to tell these stories that is not identical to the last one I saw. And that's kind of what this is.
But there have been some that you would say are different.
Hurt Locker. Hurt Locker is great.
Stop Loss?
Stop Loss is very good. You know what I think is a strong film about PTSD? American Sniper. In spite of the fact that it was picked up and run with by all the wrong people for all the wrong reasons.
Mm-hmm.
But this one's, you know, it's about adopting a dog. And the dog's beautiful. But
the dog's great.
It ain't enough.
I'm sure there's about six dogs probably playing the role.
Ain't enough.
I think that a lot of the dramatic stuff in the film is, as you say, it is fairly cookie cutter. It is fairly familiar. But I think the actual battle sequences, I think, are staged and directed in a way that's a lot more interesting than ones that I feel like I've seen so many times.
That's, if you think that, that's fine. I don't think that's true. But
all right.
Edie Falco gives a cool supporting performance as the
thankless role
as the sort of not nice mom.
Yeah.
Everything else just sort of left me yawning.
Yeah. The Parker Sawyers actually pops up and. The guy who played Obama in Southside with You.
Yes.
And I didn't recognize him.
Right.
So it's like, okay, this guy can be in other movies and not immediately, you're not going to, when he pops up on the screen, I go, oh, it's Obama.
Young Barack.
Exactly. So that's a good thing. So yeah, I mean, I get that this is not your kind of movie because it's not like the dog finds the girl soldier. Because they love her, and then they go back home after the war together. Mr. Warhorse fan.
Do not at me about Warhorse.
This is War Dog.
It is not. I'll tell you what's different.
What?
Steven Spielberg
uh-huh.
did not direct this movie with golden light and
ladles of John Williams that's slathered right. all over everything. That's,
you want to feel things. You want to feel things in a movie? Then you get Steven Spielberg to make your horse come home. Because that horse loves your ass.
I thought that the dog and Megan had a lovely relationship.
Not like Warhorse. Warhorse loved that boy.
Warhorse loves Stonewall so much.
That's right.
God.
Don't be coming at me about Warhorse.
I'm totally coming at you, Warhorse. All the movies that you will go after and then you will defend Warhorse.
Warhorse is a beautiful film.
Oh, it's a movie.
About how people and a horse love each other. You just shut up.
I would rather watch Megan Levy again than sit through
you are,
Warhorse
you
again.
You are nuts.
Anyway.
You saw Megan Levy.
Yes.
You saw Beatrice.
I saw Beatrice at dinner.
At dinner.
And
I was wanting to see Beatrice at dinner, but now it's getting these kind of mixed reviews. And I'm thinking, I'll wait till video.
I was wanting to see Beatrice at dinner because it is from the writer and director of one of my favorite movies of the century thus far. I still haven't read that A.O. Scott Mignola list of their favorite films of the 21st century. I know I need to.
I haven't. The film you're about to mention is not on that.
Oh,
list.
I'm sure it's not, because Mignola doesn't like it. And I know that the list was all about, they had to agree on the movies. That was,
oh, they had to agree?
Yeah, that's why that list is the way that list is.
Oh, because
if only
that.
One of them liked it and the other didn't.
You know what? We need to get Mignola on to talk about that list.
We should.
Let's do that.
Let's do that.
All right.
Anyway, but she is not a fan of Chuck and Buck. I loved Chuck and Buck. Which came out in 2000, so I'm counting that as this century, even though some of you are like, it didn't start until 2001.
I'm sorry, can you, that weird little thing you just did, can you say that in English?
I said, it didn't start until 2001.
Till 2001, got it. All right.
Anyway, so Chuck and Buck was this brilliantly dark comedy, and it was genuinely sort of squirm-inducing in the best way. And so, you know, this is a movie that is about an awkward situation. And I thought, oh, great. These are the perfect guys to make this movie. Miguel Arteta, the director, and Mike White, the writer. And this is a movie where you can feel the setup being put into place. You're like, okay, this is here come the fireworks. And then the fireworks never happen. So the premise is that Salma Hayek is Beatrice. She is she was born in Mexico, but her town was essentially destroyed by real estate developers, and so she wound up emigrating to the United States. She works as a healer, like she does massages and stuff, but she also works at kind of these sort of alternative therapy places. And, you know, she's the kind of person who has, like, you know, in my review of the rap, I said she's got a Buddha on her dashboard and a Blessed Virgin hanging from the rearview mirror. Like, she's very open and loving and, you know, new agey, if you want.
Right.
And so one of her clients brings her down to, like, Laguna, one of the sort of schmancy beachside communities, through a very long stretch of L.A. traffic, to give her a massage before she's throwing this big dinner, you know, for fancy business people that night.
Right.
Beatrice's car breaks down, and her friend, who's going to come from, like, Gardena to come get her, like, you know, can't be there for hours. So Connie Britton, who is the rich lady, is like, oh, we'll stay for dinner. You're like one of the family. Because Connie Britton's daughter, as a teenager, had battled Hodgkin's, and, you know, they didn't seem to be any hope for her, and they took her to this alternative healing center, and Beatrice worked with her a lot, and they had a great relationship, and now the daughter's better and at college. And so, you know, Connie Britton loves her. Her husband, played by David Warshawski, I think his name, I don't really recognize, is like, nice to her, but sort of understands more, like, no, you're somebody that we
employ.
Yeah.
Yes.
So Beatrice is there for the dinner, and then the other guests are, first it's Jay Duplass and Chloe Sevigny. He's like a young corporate lawyer type, and she has some sort of business, but is kind of a, you know, a bit of a dip.
Like a dilettante.
A bit, yes.
Okay.
And then,
does this take place in Los Angeles? Did you say that already?
Oh, yeah. It's like Laguna, yeah.
All right.
And then John Lithgow plays a horrible real estate magnate named Doug Strutt, I believe is his name.
Oh, really?
Yes. Wonder who he's supposed to be. And his wife is played by Amy Landecker. And it's like,
seriously?
Okay.
His name is Doug Strutt?
Yes. Yes.
Boy.
So it's like, okay, first of all, why are Amy Landecker and Jay Duplass both in this movie when they play brother and sister on Transparent? That's already weird.
Okay.
And then, you know, again, there's this whole setup of, like, okay, so Beatrice is this, you know, very direct and open person, and these people are all, you know, horrible rich phonies who are destroying the earth and blah, blah, blah. And so you keep waiting for these kind of great, if not, like, actual explosions, at least sort of awkward-y, you know, Curb Your Enthusiasm kind of moments of things. And there are some, but they're not that funny, and they're not that awkward, and they don't, it's very clear, obviously, that, like, the rich people are dirtbags and Beatrice is a saint, and, you know, nothing comes of this.
Okay.
And so it's a I was really disappointed. It didn't. It felt like a setup for a movie that never takes off.
Okay.
And so yeah, so that's kind of where it is.
And is it meant to be pointed satire about the likes of people like Doug Strutt?
Yes, obviously.
And
that,
it doesn't.
That is the intent.
And it doesn't
of the film.
Mine any new
not really
insights into that.
No,
guy.
Just that, like, you know, the wealthy are terrible and rapacious and are destroying the earth.
Well, we know that already.
Yeah, exactly. We know all this stuff. And then I'm not going to give away the ending, but it's quite frustrating.
Okay.
And so, yeah, overall, I just was very disappointed by this. So.
Well.
Harumph.
The end of that.
Yeah.
Why don't I talk about It Comes at Night?
Yes, why don't you?
Well, there's not much I can tell you.
Oh, great.
Without giving away things, but here's what I can tell you.
Okay.
It opens with Joel Edgerton and his son killing Grandpa.
Okay.
It is a mercy killing. Grandpa is very, very sick. And not just like, oh, I've got Alzheimer's and it's almost my time, or I've got cancer and I'm in so much pain. Grandpa is sick with a mystery illness that has spread out from the large urban centers and kills you within 48 hours, with boils and horribleness. Okay. We don't know what this illness is. We just know that it is a highly infectious disease. All you got to do is touch somebody, and you got it.
Do they burn the body afterwards?
They take him out in a wheelbarrow. They cover his face with a pillow. They shoot him in the head. They set fire to his body. This is the merciful course of action for Grandpa, who is about to convulse himself to death with pustules of stuff.
Gotcha.
Okay. Now, like I said, we don't know what this illness is. We don't know how you get it, really, other than it's real easy. Also, nobody knows what's going on outside of their little place. Something has also made communication impossible. No TV, no internet, no phone, no radio. You're done.
Telegraph?
The only thing they have is each other, so they board up their home that's in the rural, kind of near the woods.
He's also got a wife, right?
Yeah, there's a wife. Carmen Njogo plays the wife. A young actor named Kelvin Harrison Jr. plays the son. And they board themselves up in their house. And they wait. And they hope the food and water doesn't run out. One night, someone tries to break in. It's Christopher Abbott from Girls, who played Marnie's boyfriend in season one.
Right. Popped up a few times later on.
Later on.
Charlie.
Joel Edgerton takes him, ties him up to a tree, makes him sit there for like 3 days and interrogates him. Once he trusts the guy and believes the story that, you know, he's only out searching for food for his wife and kid and thought their home was abandoned because it was all boarded up, they go get the wife and the kid, Riley Keough, and this little, like, three-year-old kid, whatever. I can't forget the kid. I don't remember the kid's name, but they all move into the house together. No one's got the disease. They're all safe and sound. They're all boarded up. There is a highly specific set of rules for conduct, behavior, set forth by Joel Edgerton. Everyone obeys him. Until they don't. All right. I won't tell you what happens.
Okay.
But it's bad stuff.
Okay.
They're selling this like a horror movie.
Mm-hmm.
I quite liked it. I think it's a very good film. It's from the...
Trey Edward Schultz,
who made Krisha.
Mm-hmm.
And the it's not a horror film, but they're selling it like one, and I feel that's going to make people angry.
Well, this was A24, who did the same thing last year with The Witch.
Yes.
Which apparently is more of a horror movie.
The Witch
than this
is more of an actual horror film than this.
Yeah.
This The Witch is about a supernatural entity that's, you know, coming for this family.
Mm-hmm.
But it that comes at night.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not going to tell you what it is.
I see.
But it has a lot to do with us.
Hmm.
And the night has a lot to do with us and how we react to fear and how we react to how evolutionarily human beings react to the night.
Right. To darkness.
To darkness. And it has a lot to do with what people will descend to when they are enough afraid.
Hmm.
You know? So it's a film that is horrific and it is about fear. But it is not a horror film. To his credit, Mr. Schultz does a lot of shining cam. Lots of slow zooms in on, like, the red door. This, I described it in my review that I wrote for the wrap. You should go click on it. A symbolically red wound of a door.
Is that what Elizabeth Arden had in mind?
The door, yes, that is exactly what Elizabeth Arden meant when she invited you to come into her red door for a facial and a spa treatment.
There's also a red door on Twin Peaks this year.
There's a red door on Twin Peaks this year, too. And there's a car alarm going off outside of our apartment. So, again, not going to tell you what happens, but... this is a film about what happens when you make a fetish of security and order.
Hmm. Okay.
And you let your fear control you. Now, as a person who has a bit of a fetish
I was gonna say.
For stability and order and security, I understand these people.
Being controlled by fear.
Mm. And at the same time, I get the point of the film.
Hmm.
I think it's really good looking. I think it is stripped down and bare bones to the point of minimalism. And that's going to upset people.
Hmm.
And ultimately, it's a film about doom.
Hmm.
And is quite pessimistic.
Hmm.
I recommend it. Bibbs hates it.
I was going to ask about that. I saw that he hated it.
And, you know, I don't actually care if Bibbs hates it. I get why he hated it. I disagree with him.
Mm-hmm.
I never have to have a conversation about it with him because we know what the other one thinks. We've both read each other's reviews, I'm sure. Bibbs, if you haven't read my review, you should. I'm perceptive. So, yeah, it's you know, don't go in thinking that it's going to be scaring you to death, because it's not. It's going to be...
scaring Jessica to death.
Tearing into your, you know, ideas about what will make you safe when bad things happen.
Fair enough.
Answer? Not much.
Too bad.
Why don't you... talk about the hero.
Sure. So, a couple years ago, there was a movie called I'll See You in My Dreams.
Yes.
That a writer-director named Brett Haley did.
Yeah.
That was designed very much as a vehicle for Blythe Danner.
Uh-huh.
Which I am all in favor of because I love Blythe Danner. And
I'll
I think,
see you in my dreams. Did I see that one?
You might not have. She's a widow. She starts a friendship with Martin Starr.
Yes, yes, yes. No, I did see this.
Okay.
Yes.
Yeah. I didn't love it, but I liked it a lot, and I was glad that somebody was creating a vehicle for Blythe Danner. I think she's a terrific actress who, you know, we mostly see in supporting roles, and it was great to see her, you know, number one on the call sheet, as they say.
Right.
You know, just to hear her and see her a lot in a movie.
Yeah.
And Sam Elliott played a supporting role as the, you know, As Whitney puts it, the movie's male equivalent to the manic pixie dream girl is the flawless rescue stud. Sam Elliott was the flawless rescue stud of I'll See You in My Dreams. And I guess Brett Haley enjoyed working with him enough that he wanted to create a vehicle for Sam Elliott.
Yes.
So now we get the hero, where Sam Elliott stars as a one-time star of Westerns whose star has peaked and is now basically making a living doing voiceovers on barbecue sauce commercials.
Which is kind of, well, it is one of Sam Elliott's
side gigs for sure. Yeah.
He's a voiceover king.
Yes.
On trucks.
Mm-hmm.
Trucks and I think stuff like barbecue sauce.
Oh, totally. Yeah. Anything they need, something sort of Texas and manly and
right.
You know. So, you know, but it may spends his days getting high with his dealer, played by Nick Offerman, who had been a child actor opposite this guy on like a TV show decades earlier. And, you know, he's estranged from his ex-wife, played by Catherine Ross, who is, you know, Sam Elliott's
actual wife. His actual wife, yeah.
Has a not great relationship with their daughter, who's played by Kristen Ritter. Starts dating a woman played by Laura Prepon, who's a stand-up comedian. I am a big fan of Sam Elliott. I think he's one of those people that, you know, when you see his name in the credits, you're like, okay, well, at least, you know, something's going to be good here. I thought he totally should have been showered with awards a couple years ago for Grandma. I thought his role in that was astounding, and it wasn't the Sam Elliott role he's always called upon to play. And in just a few scenes, I thought he was just extraordinary. So, you know, I am totally team Sam Elliott. I wish I were team the hero. But this movie's kind of, it's sort of innocuous.
I like this cast, though.
Yeah, well, nobody gets to do or say anything very interesting. I didn't really buy any of the dilemmas that he was in.
Bummer.
It all just kind of skims the surface, and, you know, it's another movie like, did you see the awful The Comedian with Robert De Niro?
No, and I never will, because I was listening to the Flophouse episode that you were listening to, sort of off to the side, and I thought, this sounds heinous.
It is dreadful. And The Hero is not nearly as bad as The Comedian, but they're both movies about, like, over-the-hill guys who suddenly do a thing that goes viral. And in neither case does it feel like the filmmakers understand what going viral means or how it works.
Oh, good.
So, yeah, so on Molly, the Sam Elliott character get some life achievement award from some Western appreciation group.
On Molly.
On Ecstasy.
Oh, he has taken Molly / Ecstasy.
Yes.
Or as we used to call it back in the day, E.
E. Next is the E. So he gives this acceptance speech, and the speech goes viral, and suddenly he's getting calls again, and the whole relationship with Laura Prepon never feels believable. Like, he goes to see her perform, and she talks about him in her act, and it's like he gets offended and leaves, and it's just like, I didn't buy any of it. So it's like, as much as I like these performers, they're either saddled with roles that are nothing, or they are shoehorned into situations that feel contrived. So, yeah, this just feels kind of like a missed opportunity, unfortunately.
Mummy.
Speaking of missed opportunities.
Mummy.
All right. So.
It stinks.
It
the
stinks.
End.
It's directed by Robert Kurtzman, who I did not see this. You did. Remember People Like Us?
Remind me what that is.
The one with Chris Pine and Elizabeth Banks. And they're like half siblings or something.
Oh my god.
Yeah.
That Disney movie.
Yes.
I forgot that I saw that.
I forgot about it too until they mentioned that was the only other movie this guy's directed. He co-wrote like a lot of the Transformers movies and the first several Star Trek movies.
Okay.
So he's like Mr. kind of franchisey guy.
All right.
Well, even as a franchise movie, this thing is a disaster. So, okay.
Do we care what the plot is?
I could try to explain it, but
there's a mummy. She's real.
Yeah.
And she's evil.
She's in
I'm reading you the tagline stuff.
She's in Iraq for reasons that are complicated but are sort of explained in the movie. She possesses Tom Cruise. She wants to stab Tom Cruise with a ceremonial dagger to bring back Set, the god of death. And so Tom Cruise and this really bland lady Egyptologist have to try and stop her. Meanwhile, Russell Crowe is Henry Jekylls because Universal is trying to set up this whole Dark Universe nonsense where it's going to be their Avengers but with monsters.
All right.
Which Dracula Untold was supposed to be the movie that was going to kick all that off. But
Dracula Untold. Oh, I saw that one too. Yes. That's terrible also.
Nobody liked that one either. So now they're trying to kick it off with this one, but nobody likes this one because it's dumb. And it just, people talk a lot about movies that feel like corporate product. This is one of the most corporate productiest movies I've ever seen. It feels designed in a lab, and it's like, it has comedic elements, and then it's an action movie with big set pieces, but no, it's kind of a horror film, but oh, and actually it's really, they're trying to build this world for all the monsters to be in, and none of it matters, and none of it sticks, and none of it is interesting. Well, and
nothing does matter.
And Tom Cruise is a movie star.
Yes.
But this movie doesn't understand why he's a movie star. Like, they don't understand.
Tell me why you think he's a movie star.
He's a movie star because
I think I know why, but you tell me why.
Here's the thing. I can't quite nail down what he is, but I know after seeing this movie what he isn't.
All right.
And what he isn't is somebody who stands there with his jaw agape wondering what's going on. And he does that a lot in this movie.
Right.
And it's just like, no, that's not what Tom Cruise does. Tom Cruise is always running and jumping and falling off of things and swinging from ropes and, figuring things out and not just going, oh. But he spends half this movie going, because he doesn't know what's going on. It's ridiculous. And the woman playing the woman playing the mummy is fine. She was in Kingsman. She's the one who had the legs in Kingsman with the her.
She was cool in that.
Yeah, she's the mummy.
She's one of the few things I liked about Kingsman.
Same here.
Yeah,
she's fine in this. But Annabelle Wallace, who I don't know who she is. I think she was in the Annabelle movie, the doll thing, which I didn't see.
Okay,
she's terrible in this. Like, I have very rarely seen.
Is she terrible, or do they just treat her terribly?
Fair enough. I couldn't say for sure.
Is she bad, or is she just Miss Years Zameda on Saturday Night Live?
Where they don't know what to do with her.
A talented woman that they can't figure out what they're supposed to do with.
I cannot say based on this one performance. All I can say is she has, I don't know. I can maybe conjecture that, yeah, she's not all that good, because even a good actress would try and squeeze some life out of this nothing role, but she's just standing
like
there.
Like when Michelle Monaghan is in something bad and you're like,
bingo.
But you're so good, you're Michelle Monaghan.
Exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
Yes.
This whole thing is just headache inducing. It's terrible.
That sounds fantastic.
Ugh. I mean, even
can't wait.
Even like on What the Flick, Matt was all like, oh, get drunk and go with your friends. And, and I was like, no, it's not.
Oh, good. Then I'll throw up and be in a terrible movie.
It's not even fun on that level. It's just this attempt to be big, sort of nameless franchise, and it's not fun.
I sent you as the canary in the coal mine to this one.
Mm.
Like, I thought, maybe I'll see this if everybody I know whose opinion I respect tells me that it's fantastic.
And that is not what happened.
And that is the opposite of what happened. Everyone I know whose opinion I respect said it is, to quote you from this very show, from a good while back, the barf of puke.
Yes.
Yes.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Don't bother.
It's one of my favorite things that you ever said.
Thank you.
The barf of puke. When you say things like that, it reminds me why I married you.
Well, whatever it takes.
It's the prince. He's the prince of the barf of puke. That's my husband.
The only reason that makes me want to see another Dark Universe movie is that Bill Condon is doing The Bride of Frankenstein next. It's in nearly 2 years, so I'm sure by then we'll have maybe forgotten just how wretched The Mummy was.
Good. That'll be the thing that kickstarts this actual situation.
Exactly. Yeah. We'll pretend Dracula Untold and The Mummy didn't happen. Really, it's Bride of Frankenstein. That's where this whole Dark Universe thing is going to get leaps and bounds.
Do we know who's playing the Bride of Frankenstein?
I've heard Scuttlebutt, but nothing has been announced.
I see. Is this Scuttlebutt? You'll have to tell me off the mic.
I will do that.
Okay.
Do you have a DVD pick?
No.
Because
I forgot.
Well, maybe you'll think of one while I'm talking. I had thought about trying to do a DVD pick that would tie into the great Adam West, who we lost this week. But I think I've already recommended the Batman movie of 1966. And I know I've already recommended The New Age, the Michael Tolkien film where he plays Peter Weller's father, one of his best dramatic performances. That if you have not seen The New Age, you should see it anyway, but you should totally see it for Adam West because it's a role unlike anything else he ever played. But since I already recommended those, I'm going to go with, if they really want to make this Dark Universe thing happen and figure out a way to put all the monsters in the same movie, my recommendation this week is Abbott and Costello Meet Frankenstein.
Year of the Dog.
Okay.
That's my recommendation.
Oh, for Mike White?
That's my recommendation.
Okay.
You were talking about Beatrice at Dinner, which I have not yet seen, and I will see when it comes to streaming, because I, too, am curious, in spite of your negative assessment.
Yes.
I do want to see it, because I like Mike White's writing, I like Mike White's direction, and I like Miguel Arteta, who directed Beatrice at Dinner, and also who directed Chuck and Buck.
Right.
But Year of the Dog is directed by Mike White and written by Mike White, stars Molly Shannon as a woman whose life undergoes a series of strange transformations after her dog dies.
I need to see that one.
It is a strange... I've said this word now twice in the past 30 seconds, but it is such an odd movie.
Okay.
And moving, and by the end of it, I thought, I'm so happy I watched this. And yet I couldn't explain why it exists to so many people I know. It's the kind of movie that you, when you're trying to explain it to people, you're thinking, I'm just turning them off.
It's like trying to explain a dream.
Yeah.
yeah, no, I need to see that. And we need to go back, again, on the mile-long list of TV shows we have to watch.
Yeah.
We have to watch Enlightened.
True.
Which I keep hearing is great.
Which we still haven't seen.
I have not seen, but, you know, who's got time?
So guess what?
What?
I'm not reading letters in the way that we normally read letters. This
okay.
week. I'm reading two longish things.
Okay.
That are about films that we've already discussed.
Okay.
So the first one is from our friend Todd.
Mm-hmm.
Now, he is a retired Army officer.
Yes.
He served on McChrystal's staff in Afghanistan.
Oh.
After retiring from the Army, he took an appointment from President Obama to be an assistant secretary at the DHS.
Mm-hmm.
And then he left his job this year on January 20th. and he's great.
Yes, he is.
And he has something to say about War Machine.
Oh, okay. I have not seen this, so I'm curious to hear what he's got to say.
We... meaning he and his husband,
mm-hmm.
we just rolled our eyes and gagged our way through David Michaud's ridiculous War Machine, based on Michael Hastings' intermittently truthful but mostly absurd account of his time spent finding quotes for a story he had already written in his head. To say it's an anti-military polemic is an understatement, but that's not even what bugged me the most. I've spent enough time in the military to feel secure enough that while my friends and I have bothered to wear our nation's uniform and put ourselves on the line to protect values such as free speech, insulting caricatures of soldiers just don't hurt my feelings. It was the self-righteous attempt, but ultimate failure at creating satire. It was the plodding script and uneven tone. And it was the disgraceful attempt to try to make a statement movie while cowering behind "it's a dark comedy" that really got to me. Hastings' shameful, cowardly revenge novel, The Operators, based on his fabulous rendition of what he alleges to have witnessed in Afghanistan and Western Europe, served as the basis for Michaud's screenplay for this Netflix misfire. And so it is perhaps this that sickened me most. Michaud and Hastings are both against fighting a counterinsurgency, C-O-I-N, war, but where Michaud offers no answer for, if not coin, then what, other than a nameless actor playing a Marine corporal, doing his best plaintive Michael J. Fox-esque, "What are we doing, Sarge?" a la Brian De Palma's 1981 schlockfest Casualties of War.
Ooh, shh!
I mean, seriously, don't spoon-feed me that war is bad. Show me. Hastings, at least, had an opinion. Hastings, often championed by the political left for reasons unknown to me, favored an all-out counterterrorism war. He talked about it openly when I met him at the ISAF headquarters, and he even wrote about it before he ever arrived in Afghanistan after his then-girlfriend was killed in Iraq. Shortly after her arrival there, Hastings favored the kill-'em-all-let-God-sort-'em-out approach, or at least that's what he said to us. Honorable men like General McChrystal, who cut their teeth in a CT battle of one type or another for too long, knew that coin was necessary, that you could still kill bad guys while putting shovels in the hands of the angry young men who had not yet turned to extremism or terror. I will say this, though. Michaud got the characters of two of those portrayed at least partly right. The brash but ultimately lovable Navy SEAL, Lieutenant Commander, and a certain seething and scheming senior Army intelligence officer who later ran the military's intelligence enterprise, and after that was the National Security Advisor for about a minute and a half. If you've not yet seen the movie, don't. My curiosity got to me, and so I watched it. Now I wish I hadn't, because I am reminded how the aggressively ignorant remain that way because they believe awful movies like this represent objective facts. Thank you, Todd.
Indeed.
Yeah. I when I read this post, it was a Facebook post, I said, can I read this on Linoleum Knife? He's like, really? You want to read this on Linoleum Knife? I said, yes. I said, you're our inside man. Like, you're the one dude we know who was in the military. And high up in the military.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, that movie is a crock. Although I will say the nameless actor in question is Lakeith Stanfield.
Okay. Now, here's another letter that touches on something that we touched on last week when discussing Wonder Woman.
Yes.
Specifically, we talked about Gal Gadot's IDF service. Which, before I started reading angry posts about this on Twitter, things that said things like, posts that said stuff like, Gal Gadot supports genocide. And that stunned me. Because I was like, what are you talking about? How can that be? She seems so nice. She was Giselle. Then I learned that a few years ago, she posted on her own Facebook or Instagram, I can't remember now, something in support of the IDF, which, again, she had served in when she was 18 or something.
Every young person in Israel
has to serve in the military for a while. National service.
Yeah. Somehow Israel has become the global litmus test of, like, both political extremes will hoist it as an example of a thing.
Yes.
It's like it's getting increasingly difficult to have a rational conversation about anything dealing with Israel.
Yes.
With a lot of people.
Yes. And I, as I said last time on this show, I don't know enough to have an informed opinion about this. I can't say that the people on Twitter are right. I can't say that that the people who are, you know, on the opposing side of this are right. I know, based on my entire life of paying attention to the news and my entire life of watching the Middle East be a war zone, to me it seems and has always seemed like an intractable situation that folks in the United States and places that are not the Middle East will never quite fully understand or grasp unless they devote their lives to studying this conflict.
Mm.
Maybe I'm wrong about that. Maybe I just really don't know enough because I haven't paid enough attention. I do know this about myself personally, that I am on the side of justice for all people and humanity and mercy for all people. And I don't want people to be oppressed, and I don't want them to be genocided, and I don't want there to be artificial
walls,
and I don't want there to be crushing oppression on people who have power versus people who don't.
Yes.
I know enough about me to know that I don't want that. But I don't know the answer to what's going on over there.
No.
Because it feels like one religion that has historically been oppressed, oppressing another religion that has historically been oppressed, and that other religion fighting back with horrible terror. That's the bare bones is what it seems like. Mm. And I might be completely wrong about that. But I do know that everyone is very angry.
Yes.
About having opinions and thoughts about it. And no matter what you say, you're wrong according to somebody.
Yes.
So, we got a letter from Lady Knight the Brave.
Yes.
Who is a longtime listener.
The other LK.
And who writes us. She wrote something quite, thoughtful about this. And her first sentence is, you don't have to read this on the podcast. And then I read it and I emailed her and I said, may we read it on the podcast? So here we go. She said, I don't know if I've mentioned this, but I'm Jewish. And like a lot of the rhetoric about Gal Gadot that you are seeing online, frankly, dips into anti-Semitism. That's the other thing. I have seen this myself. I've now stopped reading the letter and I'm commenting. I've seen this myself. I've seen people who are pro, like, justice for oppressed Palestinians totally become anti-Semitic about it. And I think, well, you're not making it better. You're not helping.
Yeah.
Anyway. The dreaded Facebook post that started this furor literally included the hashtag coexistence. And she was talking about freeing Gaza from Hamas, not murdering innocent people. You guys were pretty nice about it, but I've been reading a lot of stuff coming from uninformed people. And no offense to you guys personally, but honestly, I want everyone who isn't Jewish or Muslim to shut up about Israel. I'm comfortable, frankly, me, Dave White, personally, I'm comfortable shutting up about this because justice is my lane, but it seems like, again, this situation is not my lane, and I don't know what I'm supposed to say or think or do.
I don't feel like I've gotten anything good out of any conversation I've had on this subject.
With anybody, because
you get people on the right who have one very strong set of opinions about it.
The evangelicals who are super about Israel, they don't care about Israel.
No, they want revelations to come true.
They want revelation to come true.
But even people who aren't hardcore, it has still become part of this sort of part of the dogma of the right. And then at the same time, on the left, you have this whole other thing happening. And I just feel like I'm just going to shut up now.
She continues. Muslims can hate me or Gal Gadot or whatever. They're entitled to feel how they feel, but everyone else needs to shut up right now. I've been to Israel. And I've seen the streets where you turn a corner and a lovely little neighborhood turns to destroyed buildings and rubble. The IDF does actually do stuff other than blow stuff up. They are a genuinely necessary force to protect the Israelis. I've heard stories of blown up buses. Last year, there were, I think, 70 people stabbed on the street at random over several months. You don't hear about this stuff in the news because it's happening pretty regularly. I've heard personal stories of people losing friends or family members because somebody decided to go out and buy a pizza and got blown up. There is actual terrorism in that region, and groups like ISIS or Hamas definitely don't like Jews. Basically, there are reasons for Israelis to appreciate their military, and I think there is a difference between supporting the Israeli military, that she was required to do so by serving for 2 years, and supporting every action taken by the Israeli government, which controls said military.
Always true.
I mean, the American military has done a lot of sketchy stuff in recent years, but nobody's going to get mad when we say support our troops, and certainly nobody's going to hate on Adam Driver, for instance, for his former military service and current activism involving said military. I think he has some programs where he goes out and sees the troops or something. In America, we're allowed to say we love our veterans and criticize the American government's action with that military, and I think the same logic should be applied to Israel. Gal Gadot is an Israeli woman who is proud of her heritage and where she's from, and I think that can be separated from what the Israeli government has done over the years, especially when you consider the American military has done worse and on a much larger scale. We just bombed Syria, as I recall. People like to throw Jews under the bus in a hot second over Israel and throw around Zionism like it's a dirty word. Who is it? Vanessa Redgrave? At the Oscars?
Yes.
Who talked about...
that was 40 years ago.
40 years ago, and people still remember that. Zionist hoodlums,
yes,
she called them.
Yes.
Yeah. I was a child, and I had no idea what she was talking about. I was like, what's happening? Why is everybody so mad at Vanessa Redgrave? She was in Camelot!
That's when she won her Oscar for Julia.
We throw around Zionism like it's a dirty word. The generally accepted definition is we would like a Jewish state for us to exist in. It's not like there's another place in the world where 8 million Jews can just pick up and go. A friend of mine has grandparents from Iraq. They can't go back to Iraq because it's not safe for them anymore. I don't have the figures, but I'm pretty sure most of the Jews in the Middle East are in Israel because they are not accepted anywhere else. And in the current age of neo-Nazis, desecrated Jewish cemeteries, and over 150 bomb threats to synagogues and JCCs since November, I think the existence of Israel matters, even with its problematic origins and government. Jews have a lot of Islamophobic crap they need to work out. And just like Muslims have a lot of anti-Semitism they need to work on. When discussing the Middle East, it should be known that there isn't really a good guy, bad guy dynamic that's easy to understand. People want there to be because that's easier, which is how Gal Gadot gets thrown under the bus for essentially loving her homeland, or what we in America would call patriotism, and considering the kind of problematic history in America, not to mention the rotten crap our current president is doing around the world, we do not have the moral authority to be judgy about a region that is in genuine upheaval. Please read up on Israel. I'm not even the most informed on every facet of history out there. I have Jewish friends who are much more versed. Here are some links to stuff that one friend in particular just posted in response to this very debate happening on Facebook. There's a documentary about what happened when Israel left the Gaza Strip for a time. It's called Unsettled. She provides a link to that. And then there are three other links on Wikipedia. One is about Green Line. I don't know what that means. And one is about Nakba Day, N-A-K-B-A. I don't know what that is either. So, she continues. Basically, I know I'm biased because, oh, hey, neo-Nazis. And also, I, admittedly, don't know enough about Muslim culture and history beyond what I've picked up from Tumblr. I do know that people are always so shocked about the recent resurgence of anti-Semitism when I've been dealing it for my whole life. I've actually been called a dirty Jew in my time, and I got to sit in a history class with the kids who talked about how Hitler was awesome while my teacher covered Anne Frank and showed a Holocaust documentary. And that was when I was just a kid, and we all know kids are terrible people sometimes. But now, in 2017, to see footage of a room full of men doing the Hitler salute scares me senseless. The whole thing has made me a lot more passionate about Israel and its continued existence, and I think you guys are great, but there's been a lot of dumb stuff happening online because goys do not know what they're talking about. Such as us. We do not know what we're talking about.
I didn't even bring up the Gal Gadot thing. You did.
No, Johnny did.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Basically, I was very pumped to see a Jewish Israeli actress playing Wonder Woman. And then the internet ruined that for me. And this has been a very scattered rant. It doesn't feel like a very scattered rant at all. It's just you're sort of laying out your stuff here.
And why did the internet ruin it for you? It's a hit.
Gal Gadot studied law and international relations before going into acting. What little she has said politically seems to be favoring coexistence and not all the bad stuff the Israeli government sanctions. I obviously cannot speak for her, but I'm pretty sure she's okay. And I would really like everybody to stop placing all of the everything about Israel on one person. It's unfair, and until she actually comes out and says something blatantly Islamophobic, I would like everyone in the universe to stop crapping on Gal Gadot.
Yeah, if we're not going to blame Adam Driver for Bush Cheney, we can't blame Gal Gadot for Netanyahu.
Lady Knight, thank you very much.
You have given us things to think about.
Think about and never to talk about. Because, oh God, I don't want to, I just want to, I always want to say and do the right thing. And this feels like, this feels like quicksand.
Yeah.
Like you can't, I don't know. I am anti-oppression. I am anti-killings. I'm anti the powerful using their power against the powerless. That is what I believe in.
That works. I sign on to all of that.
Yes. end of letters.
Yes. All right. Thank you for listening. Hey, you should join our Patreon page.
Sure.
There's so many great things.
There are.
Our subscribers get tons of extra shows.
Three extra shows.
Yeah. Starting with a Linoleum LKTV.
Which is about television.
And then
which is basically us doing the same thing you hear us doing here, except about TV.
Yeah.
Some prestige television shows, such as Twin Peaks and American Gods. And also
garbage shows.
Garbage reality shows,
like
such as
Fire
what happens,
Island.
What Happens at the Abbey.
What Happens at the Abbey.
And The Bachelorette.
Ugh.
We're getting a summer of The Bachelorette. Getting going right now.
Brother.
That's me rubbing my hands together.
Also, Linoleum Knife and Fork, which is a food podcast that is hosted by two film critics.
Which is ridiculous and stupid, we understand. But
people seem to like it.
But people seem to enjoy it. And we're going to fix it to do the all biscuit episode.
Yes, you don't want to miss that.
I'm making a lot of biscuits real soon.
I'm so excited about all of that, believe me. And then also, Linoleum Nights, a podcast of the evening.
Which we record most of the time in the morning.
Yes, because we also... Because
the evening
we
is when I sleep.
We do it as a Facebook Live, and we need the light in the window.
Yeah.
But you get to see us do it, and we say bad swears.
It's where we talk about politics and queer stuff. Yeah. And
not Israel, however.
Dumb, terrible... Yeah, like, oh, never. God, no, not... And then we just recently told the story of our hideous meth-dealing neighbor who got arrested, and that was fantastic.
So excited. He is gone.
And what else? You know,
just stuff.
Dumb stuff.
Things.
You don't like minimalist art. You're wrong about that. Stuff like that.
Everybody needs to get off Kathy Griffin's jock.
Kinda.
Yeah. That sort of thing.
Yeah.
So yeah, patreon.com/linoleumknife. Come check out all of our wares and join our club. And thank you for listening. We want to thank Blue, as always, for our great theme music. Go to bluetopia.com, BLEUTOPIA. And check out all the great stuff he is doing. You can subscribe to the show for free at iTunes. And we want to thank Sarah Marie 522, RB Barty, Jess Trigg, Sean Safari, and Anton RC for the reviews.
Were they all five stars?
They were.
Good.
If you have...
I require five stars.
If you have not gone to leave us a review, please do. It really helps people find this show. Because there's so many dang... podcasts out there.
There are so many dang film podcasts.
Film podcasts especially.
This is the only one hosted by two married homosexual people.
That's right. So, you know, we're special and different.
Actually, you know what? There might be a film podcast out there hosted by two married homosexual people, but they're not actual film critics like you and me.
Oh, well,
they're actual working, writing film critics.
And I'm a member of the Los Angeles
Film
Critics Association.
So we got the
creds.
We got the creds.
We're not just two random homos who felt like they could come talk about movies.
That's true. That's
in the podcasting medium.
We know stuff.
Follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at LinoleumCast. Leave us positive feedback in all the places that we stream, including Stitcher Radio and TheLounge.com and CastBox and the other ones, I forget. And drop us a line at LinoleumPodcast@gmail.com with questions or comments. You can also PayPal us $22 at LinoleumPodcast@gmail.com for our really awesome shirts.
You want a t-shirt? Sure you do.
Black t-shirts with Linoleum Knife and white letters across the chest. We have all the sizes. If you live outside the U.S., email us first and let us know where. We'll tell you how much more include for postage. But if you're in the U.S., PayPal us $22, linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. Tell us what size and where you want it sent. Go listen to all of our friends on the internet that we tell you about every week, including Dave Holmes, who was on the show a while ago to talk about his memoir, Party of One, that is now coming out in paperback.
Oh, yeah.
So if you didn't grab it before, you can now get it in a soft cover format.
Right.
And he also hosts the very funny International Waters podcast over at Maximum Fun. So go check that out if you have not already. And, of course, go listen to Pop
Didn't
Rocket.
Did you say they talked about us?
I don't know that that one's come out yet. I've been listening for it.
Oh, I
but,
see.
But when it does, I'll mention it. Pop Rocket, which both Dave and I have guested on of late, go listen to that one as well.
I love that Pop Rocket, and I always have. I've been a fan for a long time, and then I got to be a guest twice, which was like, it like made my month, seriously. And I was so excited to get to be on the show and talk stuff.
You got to be on a Guy Branum episodes. I got Margaret Wappler, which you did not.
I did not get Margaret Wappler.
We've all had our own.
I got that Groovy Winter and that Awesome Karen.
Yes, they are rad. And they were both at the march, but of course the march was gigantic, so of course we didn't see them.
Either one of them.
Anyway, thanks for listening. Y'all are great. Join our club, and we'll catch you next time.
Goodbye.